You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 10th of April, 2013, on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, coming to you live from Studio One here in London with me, Emma Nelson, and Phil Hahn.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we'll bring you the top stories you'll need to know in the next 24 hours. Our agenda setter today is Dr. James Boyce from King's College London.
Also ahead, we'll learn what the ever-expanding Emirates Airlines ambitions are as they prepare to point their nose cones towards the United States.
Emirates is operating airplanes that are far newer than many of the American carriers. Also beyond that, they're offering a true first-class service, which the American carriers at this point are not on routes like this.
We talked to the author of a book on the artist Ai Weiwei and the way he reflects the crisis in Chinese society.
And we take a tour of the business people who made their fortunes by turning their own names into brands.
If someone has the courage to put their name to their company and their brand, then I think that will attract customers more and more convincingly.
So all that plus we'll play some great music as well, all to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
First, let's catch up on the news with Barney Burnham.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. South Korea has raised its surveillance level after North Korea moved one or more long-range missiles in readiness for a possible launch. That's according to reports from Seoul's Yonhap News Agency. They say the Combined Forces Command in Seoul raised its WatchCon 3 status, the normal defense condition, by one level in order to step up monitoring and increase the number of intelligence staff. Admiral Samuel Locklear, commander of U.S. forces in the Pacific region, says the U.S. military believes North Korea has moved an unspecified number of Musudan missiles to its east coast. He told Congress that the U.S. is capable of intercepting a North Korean missile should it launch one in the coming days. He said the decision on whether to intercept would be based on where the missile was expected to land.
Well, I think if you, as you know, if you look at the architectures that we have, we will be able to sense and be able to understand pretty quickly where any launch from anywhere in the world, but in this case, from this particular site, where it would where it would be going and what we need to do about it. So I'm confident that we would be able to make that decision for defense of our allies and our homeland.
The British Parliament is reconvening today to hear tributes to the former Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher, who died on Monday. Another former Prime Minister, Tony Blair, has called for opponents of Lady Thatcher to show respect, saying celebrations of her death were in bad taste. Meanwhile, Australia's Foreign Minister Bob Carr has said that in a conversation she had with him in her retirement, Lady Thatcher made comments that were unabashedly racist. He says he was astonished by the remarks, but still respected the boldness of her political leadership. The US Senate will cast its first vote on President Obama's proposals to curb gun violence this week. US Senate Democratic leader Harry Reid has scheduled a procedural vote for Thursday to open the debate on gun control. Democratic aides say they expect to defeat Republican efforts to block the bill from reaching the Senate floor. On Tuesday, gun control supporters cranked up pressure on lawmakers with relatives of the children killed in December's Newtown School massacre meeting senators in Washington. Vice President Joe Biden has described as mind-boggling threats to block votes on new gun laws after the Newtown massacre.
I served in the Senate for 36 years, and you got 13 senators, including the minority leader, saying, I will filibuster proceeding on dealing with this national tragedy. Won't even proceed. Now, maybe between now and the time it gets to the floor, they will, as my mother would say, they will have seen the light. Maybe that will change. What an embarrassing thing to say.
A 6-year-old boy has died after being shot in the head by a 4-year-old playmate in Toms River, New Jersey. The local police chief says the boys were outside the 4-year-old's home when he went inside, got the rifle and shot the 6-year-old from about 15 yards. It's not clear whether he pulled the trigger or if the rifle discharged accidentally. The 4-year-old's parents were in the house at the time. The dead boy has been named as Brandon Holt. His uncle, Daniel Watkins, says the family is stunned.
This is really difficult to deal with. I mean, this is, something that shouldn't have happened. I mean, it's horrible.
The number of people killed by a new strain of bird flu in China has risen to 9. The H7N9 strain, which was confirmed in humans for the first time last month, has now infected 28 people, all of them in eastern China. The World Health Organization says it's looking into 2 suspected family clusters of people in China who may be infected with the virus, potentially the first evidence of human-to-human spread. A report by Amnesty International says the use of the death penalty is continuing to fall, even though some countries resumed executions in 2012. Amnesty said the resumptions of capital punishment in Gambia, India, Japan and Pakistan were disappointing regressions. But the organization's Secretary General says elsewhere the death penalty is becoming a thing of the past. The top 5 users of the death penalty are still China, Iran, Iraq, Saudi Arabia and the US. Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Barney. Barney will be back in about 24 minutes with another check of the latest news. Hello, happy Wednesday morning, Emma.
A very happy Wednesday morning to you, Phil. We are looking forward to an hour of great chat here on Midori House. I'm particularly looking forward to the interview with the man who is who's a good... Great, a gentleman called Barnaby Martin, who went to visit Ai Weiwei shortly after his arrest in China a few years ago. He'll be talking to us about a new book that he's got out. But in a moment, we'll be doing what we should be doing. I think it was Jeffrey Kaufman last week described it as the crystal ball
crystal
section
ball.
Of Monocle 24's Midori House. We'll be setting the agenda. And you're listening to Midori House live from Studio One here in London. Now, every day on Midori House, we'll bring you the stories you need to be across for the coming day.
And today, helping us to set the agenda is Dr. James Boy, Senior Visiting Research Fellow at King's College London. Thanks very much for joining us here in the studio, James.
It's always a pleasure. Good to see you both.
North Korea, still ratcheting up its rhetoric, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this is a really interesting story because not only have you got the current dimension with regards to this and the idea of what on earth the leadership in North Korea are playing at, but you've also got several long-term issues as well. And this relates into a story I'd like to talk about a little bit on about Cuba and the overall image of the Cuban Missile Crisis. And the fact that you know we could be living through something that's very, very similar in terms of its international prestige and importance and the impact it could play on global affairs.
But I guess with the Cuban Missile Crisis, you knew, both leaders knew where they stood, didn't they? Whereas here you have Kim Jong-un, who is completely a wild card and is willing to do kind of anything.
Well, we say that now. We say that in retrospect. But of course, at that point, nobody knew quite what was going on. Nobody knew why Khrushchev was putting missiles in there. And of course, the wild card at that point was Fidel Castro. So the idea that all was well and above board, I think, is perhaps applying hindsight to a very dangerous situation. And we're in a very dangerous situation now, of course. Nobody knows quite what Kim Jong-un is going to do, who's pulling the shots there behind the scenes in North Korea, and what the US is going to do. It's good to see that they've cancelled some ballistic missile tests. But of course, the fact that they were sending stealth fighters over in that general direction last week was clearly an act of provocation. And whilst no one wants to suggest that this is the Americans' fault necessarily, certainly it's encouraging to see them taking steps back, I think, and making life a little bit easier perhaps for the North Korean leadership.
No one doubts that the rhetoric has been astonishing, breathtaking, one would argue, coming out of Pyongyang. A little while ago, we interviewed Scott Lucas, a former colleague of yours, from Birmingham University and an international expert on all things sort of geopolitical.
Just all things general.
And we were talking about the G8 summit, the sure. G8 Foreign Ministers Summit in London today. And he said that G8 will not necessarily be that concerned about North Korea. They will just wait for the rhetoric, and I quote, to burn itself out. Do you think that that will happen?
Yeah, I never find it's a wise move to argue with Scott too much, but I think that what is interesting with this whole situation is it could very well be an interesting tipping point with regards to the US and China in terms of global hegemony, because of course, whilst China doesn't want to see this escalate in any way, neither does it want to see the United States getting involved on the Korean Peninsula. So this could really be an excellent opportunity for the Chinese leadership to assume a role of regional leadership, if not moving into a wider field effectively in that part of the world. What that would say about US hegemony is in the matter, I think. And really, I think that the Obama administration's got to play this very, very carefully between not being overly bellicose and ratcheting up the rhetoric, but also it's got to decide whether it wants to give China that opening. And if it does, will the Chinese leadership take it?
So we do ask our experts to look into their crystal ball, as we say. So how do you see this conflict or this crisis playing out? Is it going to be, as Scott Lucas says, the rhetoric running out? Or how do you see this playing out?
I think one of the great challenges we sometimes face working with the media is that there is a great concentration upon the here, the now, and wanting to escalate issues. There's no doubt about it. This is an issue that is escalating itself. History would reveal, I think, that this will eventually resolve itself and that diplomacy will prevail. At the moment, however, it's very easy to see how this could end up being a shooting war. But I really think that fundamentally this will eventually, I'm not going to quote Scott directly because I'd like to be a little bit more original than that, but I think this will eventually resolve itself, let's put it that way, and that I hope it will lead to a new role for China in that part of the world. Clearly they're a coming power, and this could be a real opportunity for them to step up, not just within the economic field, but within the diplomatic field as well, I think.
What is astonishing, though, is the complete absence of diplomacy that's coming from North Korea. This is, everybody else is effectively dancing to Pyongyang's tune. They give reassurance with one hand, and then the next minute they're telling tourists to leave South Korea. Then they're offering boat cruises from China to North Korea, and then they're closing the border to tourists. It is whip and kiss, as one would possibly argue. Someone was arguing, though, I read a couple of days ago, that perhaps what North Korea really wants out of this is simple recognition as a nuclear state.
Yeah, it's possible. There's also the idea that what Kim Jong-un has got to do is somehow rescue the economy of that nation. And one way to do that is to try and, use the smoke and mirrors of the nuclear threat to say, right, okay, well, if we resolve that, can we get rid of sanctions, et cetera, et cetera. The problem, of course, with this is that we've been down this road before. Back in the 1990s, the Clinton administration came very, very close to agreeing a deal that everybody was quite happy with. And then, of course, the North Koreans basically reneged upon the deal. I think George W. Bush, who's got a lot of criticism, both during and after his time in office, took one look at the North Korean leadership and said, well, they're not honest brokers. They're not worth dealing with. Let the whole thing ride, effectively, which is where we are today, unfortunately. And I think that there's no doubt that if you're going to have open negotiations, you've got to have good faith on both sides. And the problem with the North Koreans is that in the past they've demonstrated a lack of good faith, I think. So it will be difficult. I know Secretary of State Kerry's in that part of the world, is certainly going over that way. Whether he can bring any sense to this will be interesting to see. And certainly, we talk about legacy issues. It's certainly something that I think that Kerry and Obama are thinking about at this point.
And James, you mentioned earlier Cuba. That's another story which you say is setting the agenda for today. Cuba's relationship with the United States and two celebrities that may be in the country.
Yeah, I mean, I saw this and, you try and think about linkage and how things can play together and just give some interesting spins on these things. I think a lot of people know that Beyonce and Jay-Z were over there for their fifth wedding anniversary. Congratulations, guys. I don't know if either of you have been to Cuba. It's a remarkable place. I was over there on my honeymoon a couple of years ago. I can travel quite freely. I'm not an American citizen. I wasn't born in the land of the free, the home of the brave. But if you are, actually traveling freely around the world is not as straightforward as you might imagine. And there are Republican lawmakers on Capitol Hill and also Senator Marco Rubio asking very, very searching questions about why it was that these two individuals got to travel to Cuba whilst most Americans cannot. And the suggestion is that they got clearance from the state, from the Treasury Department, which of course is part of the American administration. Now, if they can travel, why can't anybody else? The fact that there's still a travel embargo on Cuba over 50 years after it was imposed prior to the Cuban Missile Crisis and after the Castro takeover, it seems quite remarkable. I mean, American citizens can travel to Cuba, to Russia, to pretty much any part of the world, but not to Cuba. And considering its proximity to the US, it really does seem quite a ludicrous situation for the United States to still be in. And one wonders whether it will take a Cuban-American president to lift that arms in that embargo.
It is one of those things that you just think, well, level of celebrity or not, how much benefit is actually a high-profile couple going to Cuba, going to actually help a situation, help resolve any situation?
Well, I don't know if they went there to resolve the situation. I think
they went on holiday.
I think when they were on holiday, and one can remember a couple of weeks ago we were talking about Dennis Rodman, for example, in Korea, and how he came back and said, well, the world would be a better place if Obama and Kim Jong-un just got together and played basketball. it's a little bit more complicated than that, I think, and I'm sure Scott would agree.
It's complicated, but it does go back to the Obama beer around the table theory. Which is a little bit weak and a little bit thin, but it's a very nice idea to embrace a very long way down the line.
It's a lovely idea.
It does. But if you do take that idea,
Scott would really be wrapping you over knuckles.
Yes, absolutely. In which case, I'm going to join you, I think.
Both hands at the same time. The problem is that if you boil it down and it becomes very, very simplistic, and if it was that simplistic, it would be dealt with very years ago and it would never reach the levels we're talking about. The problem you've got fundamentally is the American government have a series of laws in place that govern all American citizens. And the question fundamentally is, are all American citizens privy to the law, or are some people who are wealthier, perhaps more attractive, and perhaps closer to the Obama administration, who can get away with miming an inauguration cerebration, can they get away with things that most Americans cannot?
But the thing about Cuba, I've been there as well, and what I was startled as a Canadian is just how many Americans have actually been to Cuba. You know, they can fly to Havana or Varadero or any other number of holiday destinations through Canadian airports. So it's obvious that these American economic restrictions just aren't working.
Well, it's funny you should say that, because when I was there, most times you go to places, it's the Americans who are the loud, raucous ones. And there were so few Americans, it was the Canadians who were the loud, raucous ones. So, I would encourage all people who can possibly get there to go there before it changes, because clearly when the Castro regime, be it Raul or Fidel, who are running the place, go, you can see it's going to revert and the Americans will be back in there and it'll just become like any other Caribbean island. But of course, the American government would say, oh, that's terrible, you're supporting a repressive regime, for example. Well, there's repressive regimes all the way around the world and most Americans can travel freely to them. And, the theme I was most interested in addressing today was that of freedom. If you're a citizen of the United States, you should be free to travel where and when you will, as you should if you're a British citizen. And if you cannot do that, then are you truly free?
James, let's move on to an event which happened 2 days ago, yet is nonetheless going to set the agenda for at least the next week, if not months and years to come, in terms of the way that the press covers obituary. We're talking about the death of Margaret Thatcher. This has interested a lot of people, insofar as we've had violence on the streets celebrating her death, which I think took quite a lot of people aback. But it has really engaged the British, and in fact the world, into examining how much, whether you can be entirely flattering about someone who's just died.
Yeah, and again, coming back to my initial point about freedom, I think a lot of us would see that as being quite offensive, the idea that there were people on the streets, and a lot of people, I would imagine, who weren't even born when Margaret Thatcher was Prime Minister. After all, she left office, 22, 23 years ago now. What do they know about Margaret Thatcher's time in office beyond what they've heard from a Billy Bragg song? Probably not very, very much. The question, though, is, Margaret Thatcher would say, I believe in freedom of speech, freedom of the press, if she were alive today. And how far do you draw the line? Do you say, hang about a second, you've got to have freedom of speech to be able to do this? Freedom to do things which we would find offensive is part of the inherent freedoms of being in this country. Whilst one can be offended by it, one has to defend the right for people to do that in a free and open society. What I found fascinating is the degree of tribalism. I was lucky enough, I held public office back up in Solihull back in the late 90s, and got on very, very well with my political opponents. And what you find is that people who hold office tend to recognise that we're all politicians together and we've got to get on and work together for the betterment of the country or the local region. But you get a tribal gathering at a grassroots level. And I think that's what's coming out here. I think people who've served will recognise the work that Margaret Thatcher did, whether you agree with everything or not. But the fact that she was a British Prime Minister who was undefeated in her time in office is quite remarkable.
Undefeated apart from by her own party.
Stabbed in the back quite nicely.
Killed her.
Thank you very much, Dr. James Boyce, Senior Visiting Research Fellow at King's College London. Thank you very much for joining us and setting the day's agenda.
Coming up on today's Midori House, we'll find out if Emirates' plans for the US will truly take off. Stay with us.
If you like Subways, not Subway sandwiches, if you want to know what makes a metropolis thrive or take a dive, and if you prefer the concrete jungle to the muddy field, then you need The Urbanist. Join me, Andrew Tuck, as we explore the urban landscape by tram, subway and taxi to meet the people out to make urban life even better. In this episode of The Urbanist, we're looking at taxis.
These black objects that hum and buzz around London, I mean, it's the lifeblood. If you think buses are arteries, well, we're the blood cells. We're the things that actually make things work and move.
In London, we'll find out why one black cab driver became obsessed by bollards. In Delhi, we discover why women have got their own cab service. And in San Francisco, drag queens too.
That's The Urbanist, premiering every Thursday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Midori House. It is 11:19 in Dubai, 8:19 here in London. Emirates Airlines is rapidly expanding again, this time targeting services between the US and Europe. It'll bring the airline in direct competition with Alitalia, American, and Delta, all of which is good news for passengers accustomed to the service provided by Middle East carriers, but less exciting for the dismal and threadbare American carriers.
Starting in October, Emirates will fly between New York and Milan for the first time with a mix of direct flights and partnerships. In addition to passenger services, Emirates Sky Cargo will offer a total of 38 tonnes of freight capacity between both cities every day. A little earlier, Monocle's Robert Bound and Andrew Muller spoke with Monocle's transport editor Tristan McAllister to discuss the impact of this new route to the transatlantic market.
It's turning into, in some ways, the worst fears of American and European carriers, frankly. What you're seeing is that these carriers that aren't based in a place like Europe can fly from Dubai via someplace like Milan and offer service on to the United States, albeit it's not the first time this has happened, but it seems that it comes at a fairly odd time, given that there's a lot of talk about the Middle Eastern carriers on the heels of the majors in the U.S., but also the majors elsewhere in the world. And then, you know, beyond that, we're looking at this loophole that's called the Fifth Freedom, and that's allowing these carriers to essentially operate flights, like I said, that originate outside the U.S., come into the U.S., and then fly back to another point that is outside the U.S., but not in their home country. And it's a big shift.
This is in no respect imaginable at all good news for the American airlines, is it? I mean, as somebody who's spent a lot of time flying on Middle Eastern carriers and American carriers, there's absolutely no competition at all. And if the prices were reasonably comparable, and I'm guessing they would be, it would not be a decision I would take long to make.
Andrew, I think one of the things to think about here is there's actually two things to think about. First of all, Emirates is operating airplanes that are far newer than many of the American carriers, also Alitalia, with a few exceptions. And then also beyond that, they're offering a true first-class service, which the American carriers at this point are not on routes like this. So that's a clear part where Emirates has an advantage over the American carriers. And yes, on price, they can compete. You know, while most of these Middle Eastern carriers like Emirates don't admit that they get subsidy from the government or their governments in terms of fuel and whatever else, no one really knows for sure what their cost structure is like. Most of them are privately held. Most of them don't really have public-facing finances. So it's anyone's guess. So it really is tough for both the European and the American carriers.
I wanted to ask you also, Tristan, whether the idea of patriotism comes into this at all. When people are we're jumping onto a plane, maybe they don't fly that often a year. Do Americans want to jump on a plane with American written down the side of it instead of Emirates, for example?
It really depends. I think that loyalty programs are a big part of that, but when it comes to these Middle Eastern carriers sort of moving up in the world, they're now joining starting alliances with American and European carriers that allow for sort of interconnectivity between carriers, which means that alliances don't matter anymore. You'll still get your upgrade. You'll still be able to use miles. So it's anyone's guess as to how these American carriers and European carriers compete with the Middle Eastern carriers. But beyond that, you know, in terms of flagship and patriotism and all that with country carriers, I think there's not a lot to be said for American carriers at this point. I think the service offers aren't very good, and I think that Americans are interested in trying a different experience if it's going to be better and at a similar price point.
There's another aviation story I wanted to talk to you about, which is less good news for transatlantic flyers such as myself, i.e. the ones who really don't enjoy the experience of being rattled around like a dice in a box 2 miles off the ground. It's going to get bumpier, apparently.
Yeah, well, at least that's what scientists in the UK are saying. They say it's simply because of global warming and that the jet streams in the atmosphere, which are enhanced or sort of shifted by changes in ambient air temperature, will increase or get stronger. And what that means essentially is more clear air turbulence, which is the leading cause of that, you know, middle of the sky, no clouds around, really no warning turbulence. And that is what is giving people broken arms and hurting flight crews. crews and forcing planes to make emergency landings. And, well, it's not really going to bring an airplane down. It's going to make it a lot less comfortable to travel.
And does that potentially change the... even just the interior design of these airplanes? We're going to get squishier seats, safer seat belts. I mean, really, I wonder. I mean, reading some of these statistics that you gave us before the interview, Tristan, it's interesting that there's potentially a 40% increase in this sort of turbulence over the next 20 years.
Robert, I think that's a really good question, and it's funny.
I'd want a squashier seat.
Well, when you look at what these carriers,
possibly a parachute,
of course, and you know, you look at what these carriers are doing, and a lot of them, especially in economy cabins, are reducing the size of the seat, reducing the cushiness. You know, I don't know that there's much more room to go any lower in terms of how comfortable a seat could be, and now we're getting the word that maybe the turbulence will increase, and you think, well, gosh, maybe we need to like pad the cabin or something like that, just to make it so that people don't get hurt.
That was Monocle's transport editor Tristan McAllister talking to Andrew Muller and Robert Bound a little earlier about padding cabins. Ai Weiwei is arguably the poster boy of protest in China. The art has arguably taken a secondary role to the man himself as well, whether it be his arrest, his release, or even his parody of the Gangnam Style video. A new book, written by a man who knows him better than most, attempts to chart the artist's career from before his rise to fame to becoming the world's most famous political prisoner.
Barnaby Martin travelled to China to interview Ai Weiwei as he was held under house arrest, and he joins us now to talk about his new book, Hanging Man, The Arrest of Ai Weiwei. Barnaby, you have a very personal relationship with Ai Weiwei, and you risked quite a lot by travelling to China and visiting him when he was under house arrest.
Yes, hello. I'm not sure I could go so far as to say I risked a lot, because in general, people who don't hold a Chinese passport aren't at risk in the way that Chinese passport holders are. I did see him after he had just been released from detention, and he was under sort of, you know, police observation, the police all around the building and so on. But I don't want to make any claims about my personal jeopardy. I was perfectly safe.
Your book, which it sort of starts from before Ai Weiwei's birth, doesn't it? You place him in the context of Chinese political history, and in particular, you talk about his father Ai Qing, who was a political pariah and suffered appallingly as a result of this. Tell us a little bit more about it, and tell us if you think that Ai Weiwei is a direct product of his family and his circumstance.
Yes, that's a good point. His father, Ai Qing, was a poet, actually a very famous Chinese poet, a sort of poet laureate. He was actually born right at the beginning of the century and grew up in the sort of tumultuous period after the collapse of the Qing dynasty, which was in 1912. And after 1912, China entered a period of sort of semi-chaos, because there was no central government. It's quite an exciting time for people to grow up. Ai Qing went to art school and then finally to France, like so many of the actual communists did as well. And he studied in France, and then he returned to China in the 30s, where he was a painter actually at this point. But he was jailed for being a communist, and he started to write poetry in jail. And his poems were very communist in spirit and sentiment. And he was sort of taken under the wing of the fledgling Communist Party, and in fact he became a close friend of Chairman Mao's. And so, in 1942, he advised Mao on what the policy about art literature should be, once the Communists took control. And in 1949, when they did take control, he was a very popular and well loved figure, and everyone knew his poetry and quoted it. But of course, like most people, he fell out of favour with Mao, and in 1957 he was sent down to the countryside, where he had to clean up public toilets in a little village in the Gobi Desert, and that's where Ai Weiwei spent his youth. So, as you say, it seems to me that there is a link between the treatment of his father and his own sort of hell-bent program to bring down the Communist Party, because he regarded it as hypocritical.
This book does paint a fascinating picture of what actually happens to Chinese political prisoners. How do you think Ai Weiwei's arrest in 2011 impacted him? Do you think it empowered him, or did it leave him dampened in terms of his spirits?
Well, I mean, that's a very good question. It's one of the things that intrigued me about the interview, without wanting to be to sound sort of inhuman, but as I was sort of listening and watching him, because it was only a few days after he'd been released, it was, you know, he was clearly in a state of extreme trauma because he'd spent 81 days in this bizarre situation, which is sort of solitary confinement because you're on your own in a cell, but at the same time you're being guarded all the time by two guards who are staring at you, and of course you're not allowed to look at them, you're not allowed to speak to them, so it's very lonely. But at the same time, you're with other human beings. It's been, you know, a grotesque situation, and obviously he didn't know whether he was going to get the death penalty or if he was going to go down for 10 or 15 years, like, you know, Liu Xiaobo or other people. So when he was suddenly released, he was completely disoriented. And I would say brainwashed to some degree. They know what they're doing. They're very experienced, these interrogators. And to begin with, he was shocked and obviously traumatized, and no doubt still is. But he's definitely bounced back in the sense that this sort of anger and frustration has returned. And in a way, I say because he survived, he's probably given him more strength.
It's given him more strength, but there's a great quote in the book where he describes how they treat him in prison. They say he was like a Ming vase. Effectively, there was this real need to keep Ai Weiwei in one piece because he was precious due to the fact that he had garnered so much, so much of the world's attention. How much of this is Ai Weiwei aware, and how much does he use that in terms of his work now?
I think he's highly aware of that, because of course the acid test was the fact that he wasn't tortured beyond the sort of mental torture of his incarceration. So once he'd been through that horrible experience, he knew that up to a point he would always be immune from abuse by the regime. However, obviously there's always at the back of his mind the thought that any time anything goes wrong in China, if there's a sort of Because of course it all could kick off. It could be a riot in Shanghai to do with something totally unrelated, and then they'll just round everyone up, and that'll be that. And he won't be coming out again. So he treads a fine line, and that's his skill, I guess, one of them.
Barnaby Martin, thank you very much indeed for joining us. That was Barnaby Martin, author of Hanging Man, The Arrest of Ai Weiwei, a book which is out now. You're listening to me, Dory House, on Monocle 24, where the time is 32 minutes past the hour.
In the next half hour of the programme, we'll head to Cannes to find out what television shows have been the biggest hits at the annual MIP TV conference. We'll also look at the names of businesses and the entrepreneurs who have made themselves the brand when we hear an interview with Charles Valance, author of the new book, The Branded Gentry, how a new era of entrepreneurs made their names. But first, before all that, here's Barney Burnham with the latest news.
Thanks, Phil. South Korea has raised its surveillance after North Korea moved one or more long-range missiles in readiness for a possible launch. Seoul's Yonhap news agency says the Combined Forces Command raised its normal defense condition by one level in order to step up monitoring and increase the number of intelligence staff. The British Parliament is reconvening today to hear tributes to the former Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher, who died on Monday. Another former Prime Minister, Tony Blair, has called for opponents of Lady Thatcher to show respect, saying celebrations of her death were in bad taste. The US Senate will cast its first vote on President Obama's proposals to curb gun violence on Thursday. US Senate Democratic leader Harry Reid has scheduled a procedural vote to open the debate on gun control. A 6-year-old boy has died after being shot in the head by a 4-year-old playmate in New Jersey. It's not clear if the 4-year-old pulled the trigger or if the rifle discharged accidentally. The number of people killed by a new strain of bird flu in China has risen to 9. The H7N9 strain, which was confirmed in humans for the first time last month, has now infected 28 people, all of them in eastern China. A report by Amnesty International says the use of the death penalty is continuing to fall, even though some countries resumed executions in 2012. The top 5 users of the death penalty are still China, Iran, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, and the US. Those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Barney. Barney will be back at the top of the hour with another check of the international news headlines. You're back with Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Phil Hahn, and Emma Nelson. It is 8:34 here in London. What's in a name? In business, apparently, quite a lot, and a bad name can kill any hopes of success. A good name, however, can at least let you live to fight another day.
For an entrepreneur out to build a startup or business empire, this is the critical first step, the most important piece of branding they'll undertake. While some of the best names in business have been utterly meaningless to customers, but were then embraced by customers, and the rest is history. Think about Google.
Then there are the entrepreneurs who make themselves a brand. Charles Valance is the chairman and founding partner of the ad agency VCCP. He's also the author of a new book, The Branded Gentry, how a new era of entrepreneurs have made their names. Now, for this week's edition of our weekly business show, The Entrepreneurs, our Sophie Grove speaks with Charles to see how people from Paul Smith to John Sainsbury got their start.
We decided to write it because David and I have worked together, me as an ad man and David as a researcher, since the middle of the 80s, and we'd seen this rise of fantastic British brands such as Orange, such as Dyson, such as First Direct and Pret a Manger and everything. And we thought someone ought to write up the story of these brand successes. And at the same time, we had this idea that there has been this shift of emphasis away from, if you like, old establishment influence towards more branded marketing influence. So we had this pun of the landed gentry moving to the branded gentry. In the end, though, what we thought we'd focus on is people who'd had the courage to put their name to their brand. So not just brands in general, because that could just be like another business book. We wanted this to be a book about personalities and people and their drives and motivations.
The book is fascinating, and the branded gentry, it's called, something of an interesting concept, really. We're talking about the brand, but also this idea of names and taking on your own family name and making it into a brand, really.
Yeah.
Can you tell me a bit about the history of this? I mean, we're so used to seeing it around us, we almost take the eponymous brand for granted.
Yeah, well, in some ways it's meant to be lighthearted, and it's actually meant to be a lighthearted read. It's not a serious business tome at all. It's really about people. It's not about business. But there is something in this idea that there was a new class of individuals that came along that created their wealth not from the land they owned, but from the brands they created. So that thus the pun, moving from the landed gentry to the branded gentry. But specifically, when we looked at the success stories in consumer markets, in branded consumer markets, the ones we wanted to talk to were the ones who had actually had the nerve to put their name to the brand. So they actually stood up and were counted. There's a number of reasons, but principally the reason that's interesting is that you can talk to them about their lives. You can talk to them as people, not as business people. Because actually business is, without wishing to be too disparaging, relatively dull. Most business stories are similar in that the business either fails, is moderately successful, or is extremely successful. What's interesting is the motivations and the human story behind those businesses. So we could get straight into questions such as, what was the view out of your bedroom window when you were a child? Now, Lord Sainsbury found that quite odd. He'd never been out, and he couldn't remember, in fact. His first memory was of being bombed in the war. But people immediately opened up by being asked questions that were nothing to do with the businesses they'd created. Although what we found is a massive amount of continuity between their stories in their formative years and then how they behaved in their adult years.
And do you think that all of these different people have something in common? I mean, you've talked to Emma Bridgewater, who's a ceramicist. You've talked to Sir Tim Bell, who's a PR man, something of a legend, really, in political PR. Paul Smith. They're very different people and different entrepreneurs, but the fact that they have been bold enough to put their name to their brand, do you think that that gives their brand something extra, something more personal?
Well, the common feature between all of them, and we expect to find lots of commonalities, and to be honest, there are lots of differences. But there were five or six things that united them. And the biggest one, interestingly, is insecurity. These are people who are massively insecure, will happily admit it. Many of them have had breakdowns of one type or another. But what they do is they harness their insecurity to give them tremendous drive. And I guess people who lack confidence can go one of two ways. They can either just sort of sit back and let the world happen to them, or they can channel it and say, no, I'm going to impose myself even more as a result of some of the challenges I face in my life. And that's really the common. These people had two qualities. One, they did have self-doubt, but it drove them forwards rather than backwards. And then the second is that they could spot an opportunity. And if an opportunity presented itself, they then seized it. They didn't hang around. And it's interesting. I wonder whether there's anything more to business success than that, which is just don't watch, don't be a spectator, be a doer, that just seems to be inherent in these people.
It's interesting, you start the book with a really beautiful prologue talking about, you know, your own childhood, looking out at, you know, the valance business, the electrical parts. You know, your own family had a shop, or a chain of shops with, you know, the family name attached to it.
Yeah.
It's very public. It's part of our society in many ways, and it used to be much more a part of our society.
Yeah.
Do you think that things are really changing, and has the brand and the eponymous brand really sort of fallen off?
One of the unintended findings of the book is that it is out of fashion. Whether it's a fashion that will come back again is another matter, but it has become unfashionable to put your name to your business. You know, we live in a world of Carphone Warehouses, Virgin, Pret-a-Manger, Orange, O2, Microsoft, Facebook, Google. Now, we might know the names of the founders of those brands. Sometimes they are synonymous, but they haven't put their name to the brand. And frequently we don't know the name of the people behind the brands. Will it come back? It's interesting. I think in one sense, every fashion has to come back because that's the nature of fashion. Things go through peaks and troughs. So I'm optimistic in that sense, but that's a bit fatalistic. The other reason is I think accountability will become more and more desirable as we trust less and less in institutions. And I think if someone has the courage to put their name to their company and their brand, then I think that will attract customers more and more convincingly.
Charles Valance talking branding with Sophie Grove for this week's edition of The Entrepreneurs. You can catch that full interview on the show and lots more at 1900 hours London time.
You're listening to Midori House. We'll be back right after this with a quick scan of what's happening at the television get-together of the year.
Grasse is legendary when it comes to the alchemy of perfume making. Monocle's film crew travel to the south of France to discover a new generation inheriting these traditions and making them their own.
My first souvenirs, we were working with flowers with my sister, trying to create and invent and of course sell some perfumes from our own. So yes, it was in our DNA, but perfume is a wonderful world and we're very lucky to have that in the family.
Making Sense, in the film's menu on monocle.com.
And welcome back. You're listening to Midori House with me, Phil Hahn, and Emma Nelson. The time here in London is 8:42 a.m. The annual MIPTV conference has opened its doors at the Palais Festival Conference Centre in Cannes. This year marks the 15th anniversary of the event, which, along with its partner event MIPCOM in October, is still one of the most important gatherings of TV executives from around the world.
11,000 participants will be flying in from 100 countries, with more than 1,000 broadcasters and production companies represented from around the world. World. Sounds busy. Joining us on the line from Cannes is Lisa Campbell, editor of Broadcast Magazine, tasked with a grim job. Lisa, how is Cannes this morning?
Oh yeah, it's really miserable. I'm standing here in the rain, and it's amazing. I think everyone, certainly from Western Europe, is enjoying the sunshine, which is a rare thing for us. So we're all discussing how, you know, it's -6 in Copenhagen right now, whatever. But we're here in the sun. Yes, it's great.
And one of the highlights, headlines from this year's conference so far has been what seems to be the decline of reality shows. Thank goodness.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of, in some ways, it's hard to pull together a theme from MIP. You know, you walk into the Palais and there are literally thousands and thousands of shows on offer, basically. I mean, people are just buying and selling. It is a market. You know, but I think the thing uniting things in the past, it was, you know, reality TV or it was cooking shows or, you know, it was, I mean, in some ways it was sort of lowest common denominator, what works across the world. Whereas this year it's really interesting. It's all about scripted. It's all about drama, really. Really sort of driven by America and the cable realizing that you can get huge ratings from drama, so much so that you can compete with the networks and actually outperform them. You know, the likes of ABC and NBC and CBS and Fox, the big guys. So something like The Walking Dead is outperforming all of those guys in America. And so all the other cables are sitting up, taking notice, investing in scripted rather than non-scripted, you know, sort of factual and reality TV, because it helps identify channels. You know, it really sort of sends out a message, you know, watch this, you will get this kind of quality drama. We're not the same as everyone else. So it's really making individual channels more distinctive. And so it's being driven from the US, and then it is happening all over the world. So, you know, a lot of production companies such as Endemol, who are very famous for Big Brother, are announcing, you know, we're in the scripted game, you know, we're moving into this. So they're producing a drama for AMC called Low Winter Sun. You know, it's very much the message of the market. So, you know, there's some interesting new projects that have been announced. You know, and company countries such as you know, Norway, Sweden, Denmark, who have really risen to global attention because of the likes of The Killing and Borgen and The Bridge. You know, all eyes are on them now. Sort of, you know, what are they producing next? What can we buy? What, you know, where can we get in there first?
It is -6 in Copenhagen, Lisa, but are the Danes still enjoying their moment in the sun? I mean, you mentioned The Killing, you mentioned Borgen. We have been talking about these for, it seems like, an eternity. Can this be sustainable? Because the quality is so good.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. I think the Danish broadcaster DR is being actually really brave. I think it, you know, it would have been easier, and what the Americans do is just, you know, when something works, they just keep churning it out. You know, 24 or Homeland or, you know, these kinds of shows will just keep going and keep going. Whereas The Killing, you know, after three series, that's it. The same with Borgen. And now they're actually making quite a significant departure away from crime drama. You know, their view is we just have to keep refreshing our slate. We you know, we're not going to just keep turning out the kind of Nordic noir. And, you know, crime drama does travel, you know, it from sort of time immemorial, really. You know, crime dramas have worked around the world, you know, from Poirot to, you know, Inspector Morse to Miss Marple. You know, this does work across territories. But what they're saying is, you know, we are moving away from that. It's time to do something else. So they're doing a family drama, which is quite sort of improvised. They're doing a big historical drama called 1864, which is based around a war in Denmark with, you know, with Germany, and how that affected, you know, almost, you know, the Danish psyche as a result. And they're doing a bit of a crime drama, but it's linked more about around the economy. And the working title is Follow the Money, and it's the sort of impact of the, you know, of the recession, really, and kind of what people do as a result. You know, and they are admitting, you know, we are famous for this, and we may completely alienate everybody and lose all our fans and everything else, but we, you know, we have to think about moving things on. But the other thing is, you know, co-productions and countries working together to produce big dramas was always a bit of an issue. You know, it was sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't, and, you know, a lot of the time you ended up with, you know, the classic Euro pudding. And I think now budgets are such that, you know, people have to work together if they're going to do anything half decent, and they've learned to do that in a way which, you know, preserves the vision of the writer. It's about the creativity. It's not about the money and making this work. It's very much about, you know, what is the audience for this? How do we preserve the vision?
Lisa Campbell there, thanks very much. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have for today. But Lisa, in the glorious surrounds of Cannes at the MIP TV conference, speaking to us there, the editor of Broadcast Magazine.
Now, while Lisa swans off down the Croisette, we are hotly anticipating the arrival of David Pleasant, because he'll be going through the French newspapers and the Italian newspapers with us, taking us there and sticking with the broadcast theme. This is Will Do by TV on the Radio. And that was from New York, TV on the radio with Will Do. You're listening to Midori House.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
And welcome back to the program. It is 8:51 here in London. We have time now for a check of the day's international papers. But today we'll be having a bit of a French and Italian twist, and we're joined in the studio by Monocle's researcher, David Pleasant. David, thanks very much for coming in.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
You've got the rustle of the Italian and the French papers, I can hear. But I
have indeed.
We will go to the
very European.
We will go to the Le Monde first.
Yeah, and Le Monde is leading with the austerity debate, something that's always in the press in France nowadays. But this is really on the back of the Kozak scandal with who resigned. He was the budget minister who has been found to have had a Swiss bank account with secret funds. What's interesting is that it's reviving this whole austerity debate. The Minister for Industrial Renewal, Mr. Monberg, is saying that austerity, as the government is expressing interest in, is very dangerous and is in danger of ruining all the progress of the last few years. So that's Le Monde's lead. What's quite interesting is the further debate about austerity and that going into the French health system, something very sacred to France. So we have this article about the French wanting to start something called bed managers, which doesn't sound that surprising to maybe the English audience, something that the NHS has had for a long time. But this is causing quite a lot of shock almost within the French press. So this is a system whereby people would be responsible for allocating beds within French hospitals. Someone's saying in Le Monde that this is as stressful as being an air traffic controller.
It is quite an astonishing idea that they don't actually have this already. What surprised me about this, David, is the way that the Kozak scandal has opened up that question, which very, very few French people have dared to ask thus far, which is, at what point does the private life of an elected member of the authority of the French government have to be personally responsible to the people who voted him in? And I think the fundamental problem with Kozak is that he lied.
Exactly. And I think that there is this opening up, as you say. I think people are really starting to talk about moral issues. I mean, the word moralization is all over this Le Monde. And I think that the direct consequence of his misdemeanor is being questioned.
It's funny, though, because it's always one of these things that you see the French very, very prominent public figures always seem to, how do I say, get away with it, because that would be downright libelous. But there always seems to be a legitimate reason for why they seem to be embroiled in financial scandals.
Exactly.
And one wonders at what point people will say enough is enough. I think perhaps is it the fact that austerity is biting so hard in France now, that people are now beginning to get, in the same way that people have been angry with bankers, that people are now beginning to say, actually, no, I want everybody to be brought down a few pegs.
To a certain extent, although I mean, I think this, the Kozak has been a kind of clean cut. He has now resigned. He's kind of been got rid of. And that's maybe something of a break with the past if we look at how other politicians have been dealt with. So maybe it's a slightly different take on things now.
And where's François Hollande in all of this? Obviously, you know, he's at near record low approval ratings, many saying it's lame duck presidency already. Do you think this will kind of rejuvenate his arguments then for transparency, for a bit of more austerity?
Well, I think that what's quite interesting is he's just kind of absent from this debate. If we're looking at Le Monde, if we look at Le Figaro, he's just not there. And I think that's quite indicative of his position right now. As you say, he's in terrible state in the polls, and maybe he's just thought the best strategy is actually to step back and let some of his more charismatic ministers take over for the time being while his polls kind of are so low. And just talking of other newspapers, if we go to Le Figaro, they are leading on the marriage debate. Well, it's not really a debate anymore. It's been passed at the first stage for the Marriage for All bill has been passed. What Le Figaro is picking up on is a considerable amount of dissent from the communists, the radicals, and the socialists. A lot of them abstained from this vote. although a lot of the UMP, the centre-left, centre-right members have also stood away from voting this in. But generally, it seems to have gone down quite easily in the French Parliament. If we cross the Alps and go down to Italy, La Repubblica is obviously embroiled in the Bersani-Berlusconi leadership challenge.
It's kind of gone away, hasn't it? And then you keep thinking, oh, actually, Italy doesn't have a government yet.
Exactly.
They're still doing this. And one thinks that it's getting closer and closer and closer that there'll be a re-election. But this article in La Repubblica is focusing on women their emergence. And there are different, how do I say this? There are different kind of girls to the ones that Berlusconi had appointed.
Exactly. I don't want to get involved in those kind of social stereotypes. They are senior, hardworking women.
Yes, exactly.
So this is a story about the race for the president. So once the Senate has been formed, then they have the challenge of finding a president. And they better be quick because Giorgio Napolitano's term is up imminently. But it seems like a lot of people are backing the idea of a woman president for Italy. And there's quite a few contenders. And in pole position is Emma Bonino, someone that people might have heard of. She was a former EU commissioner, a kind of no-frills, no-nonsense, heavy-smoking character, really. And she's really quite well-liked in Italy and respected. She's always a voice of reason in the country, and she seems to be in pole position. It's quite interesting to see this kind of debate.
She sounds like my kind of girl, indeed. David Pleasant, thank you very much indeed for joining us for a thorough roundup of what's happening in the French and Italian papers. I'm afraid that's all we have time for today's programme. Our thanks to our producer, Marcus Hippie, our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and James Bullock, and to our studio manager, too, Chris Fitch. Up next, after the news, The Menu, hosted by Marcus Hippie. He's jumping out from behind the control room glass to come present The Menu. And at midday London time, we'll have Monocle's design editor Hugo MacDonald hosting the briefing live from the heart of Milan at the 52nd Salone del Mobile Furniture Fair. Phil will be back, won't you, with Sophie Grove from Midori House at the same time tomorrow. But from me, Emma Nelson.
And Phil Hahn. That's it. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening.
A Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.